Join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on.
Welcome back. He's out of people to set on fire, and he's formerly of the metal group The Leeches. We got Court from Cinema Psyops.
None of that is actually true, other than the fact that I'm out of people to set on fire.
Yes.
I was never in a band called The Leeches. I am, however, of Cinema Psyops, and my name is Court Psyops. Well, maybe some of the setting on fire stuff. Yeah, okay, I'm out of people to set on fire, for now. The reachable people that I could set on fire. The people that were within my grasp of vengeance, sure.
I'm your host, Sully, and I'm out of sexy people to double penetrate. So
I have so many questions on how that's possible when you're just one man, but I'm not going there.
In my mind. Anyway, so we were talking about Star Trek fan films on this previously, and I was actually inspired when Court had to actually force himself to finish the entire Texas Chainsaw franchise.
Oh, okay.
So many of them feel like a fan film. And I was just like, I know for a fact he's a huge Hellraiser fan. He even gives so many of the other non-Clyde Barker ones some kind of credibility, as opposed to the other fans who like to do the whole kind of almost like to be worse than Halloween or Star Wars, where it's like, oh, you can't like this installment, how dare you.
Yeah, most people are purists and they're like, you got to stop it too. Some people even just don't want to even acknowledge too. I'm weird in that I started disliking them after five. I was still kind of okay with, but I was like, pretty much, yeah, this isn't that great, but I still like some of the ideas they have here. And they went back and did some of the original lore that was in the Hellbound Heart novel.
Yeah, they start sticking to more of the books. I mean, Barker seems to kind of rival Stephen King in that, I don't know, it's just like, it kind of just goes back to, you do realize you are a fanboy and you can think for yourself. You don't have to just kind of be an elite where you're like, I will only agree to this or that. How dare you, sir? You know, you can't. It's like,
I don't think I could live with that like that anyway. I mean, I am not the kind of person who usually follows. Like, everybody's like, hey, we're all going to go do this. And I'm like, that sounds great. You guys go do that. Where are you going to be? Here.
Here. Not there.
Right. Right. Yeah. You guys go do that fun thing. I'll be over here. No, that's not for me.
It's the same thing when you invite people to dinner, when you do the whole, it's just like, yeah, and guess what? This is about the seventh time we're having this chat, and I don't eat that kind of food or like that environment, or we can't hear each other speak over the loud, you know, it's a sports bar type place. So, yeah, it smells of smoke, and there's, again, I can't hear you because there's loud TVs and music in the background. It's too much. So,
well, I was more or less talking about following the crowd, but there is also that, too. I'm also just tired of people. So I don't like to go out.
Yeah. Whatever happened to just kind of a private dinner setting, you got like maybe 200 people and you're good. But I think following the crowd definitely applies to Hellraiser the most, because like, I don't know, like I would even see people complain about which ones got good or bad reviews. And it's like, none of these got good reviews from critics. It was a cult franchise for a reason. So it's like, and even Barker was even involved with part 3 and 6, but people don't want to even acknowledge that because they don't see his name in the credits. And it's like, well, if you need a credit to confirm someone's involvement, then most of us know just by looking at the IMDb app nowadays. And
well, and his friend Pete Atkins is the one that ended up taking over a lot of this stuff, and Pete was still bouncing things off of Clive. And also, like a lot of the movies, even some of these fan films we're about to discuss, they're taking information and they're taking story bits and pieces from the comic books that Clive kind of oversaw and wrote some of, or just basically would lay out a story
That's
arc
a
of what he wanted of his Hellpriest. So, I mean, like, a lot of the folks that complain about this stuff, it's not just Hellraiser. I mean, there's every fandom has their own toxic sort of cesspool of fans that, like, the rest of us that just want to enjoy the shit that we enjoy really have to just kind of, like, push our way through, or, you know, just wash it away and just, like, get rid of, in the sense of just, like, ignore them. You know what I mean? Like, we're giving credence to it because it's something that you have to bring up and it's something that you have to discuss. And it's kind of what I did touch on that a good bit with the stuff with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre films, because there's so much bad blood between the newer film crew and folks that did the shot, all that stuff with like Daniel Pearl in the 2000s and the horrible shit that asshole who played Leatherface
was an idiot and just total shithead to a bunch of the original guys. And I mean, Tobe Hooper kind of had some cynicism about it because it's like he made a serious movie that, you know, was run by mobsters, and then he does second movie, which was made by a campy, you know, ego-driven company known as Cannon Films. So this is like, a very interesting kind of franchise. And like you say, I mean, people even like to take producers at their word, and it's like they only mean as much as what return they get with their wallet. You know, the franchise may very well be actually dead to them the minute, you know, they don't get a return.
Well, and that's really kind of the crux of the problem, especially in the later Hellraiser series of films. Like, pretty much from 5 on, they took different scripts that were different movies entirely and then shoehorned the Box and Pinhead into them, some with varying degrees of success. Some of them work better than others, and some of them are still somewhat entertaining in spite of that. But
I'm with you, I totally concur, because like Rick Botta was a pretty talented cinematographer, but you know, he didn't have the best scripts to work with, and so his job was to just show a visual kind of tour de force that you can afford at $2 million. And it was being filmed back to back with, you know, it just wasn't even in the best studio hands to begin with. Had it been with any other independent company besides New World or Anchor Bay, I think it could, I mean, maybe Lionsgate might have treated it better, or maybe it might have gone astray like they did with their Wishmaster and Candyman franchise. So I don't know. You know,
didn't Miramax end up getting the rights, and they're the ones that ended up putting out all the shit ones at the end?
Yeah, because it was Dimension Films. So yeah, it's like, and it's going to be even more interesting when we get into one of these fan films, because it crosses over with their other franchise, The Prophecy, one of these fan films.
Yeah, that was a really interesting one. Like, that's kind of the fan film stuff that I'm used to, where like somebody who's legitimately a fan of two different franchises finds a way to try and mash them up in a story because they just want to see how that happens.
I even tried doing it with some fan films I tried working on. I stopped doing a lot of fan films around the same time I stopped doing a lot of independent film, because I kept encountering people who just, they don't get it. They're just like, oh, so we're recreating it. We're doing a spoof. No, you're doing a fan film. What does that mean? It's just like they didn't comprehend. You're making a fan made, like, this is part of the contest. Do a fan film that's based on an existing property. Can you pay me? Yes. But in certain cases, especially with Star Trek, no.
Yeah, there's really odd. Fan films are definitely like a minefield when you try to go through them, because there are folks that will spend ridiculous amounts of their own personal money to make a movie that means something so personal to them, and it's a story that they want to tell.
It's like, you gotta be in a film friendly like state like New York or California, right? Maybe even right. In the case of these movies were being filmed dirt cheap in places like Oklahoma and North Carolina.
Right. And like to varying degrees of success on whether or not it becomes a little bit more than, you know, like a fan film. But there's also the minefield has a lot to do with like the overall quality, like I was getting at, where some people will spend ridiculous amounts of money and they'll make like this like really nice, like really cool, heartfelt film that they spent the money on, they spent the time on, you know, they made sure they got actual actors and all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And they did something with it. And then there's a fan film where it's like the kind of thing that I would have done when I was a kid, where you come up with a bullshit idea just because you have a Michael Myers Legos mask and yeah. some Legos and some other shit, right, or whatever it is that you get your hands on. You have a fucking bullshit video camera that, you know, you snagged from your best friend, and you shoot a Michael Myers movie, you know, in your house because you got nothing better to do on a weekend when you're like fucking 12, you know, like there's that kind of fan film, or even like, you know, in your teen years and you're thinking you're gonna be a filmmaker but it doesn't work out, that kind of thing, you know, like that's
so true.
And some of the fan films we're going to talk about tonight are very much that, where they are non-actors, they are non-directors. It's very much and very obviously shot on the home video camera. And trying to compare that against something like Truncliffe's No More Souls is one of the ones that we're going to talk about. That guy was like a special effects artist and had money when he made
Since
that.
Part three, yeah. And I mean, people didn't even realize he did effects for like even other big stuff. Like he designed Wolverine's claws in one of the lesser X-Men. He was involved with Blade. You know, he was always constantly like one of the top makeup guys who wasn't named Rick Baker or Stan Winston. You know, he was more like some of the guys who, you know, he was more like a Robert Kurtzman. He was going around and often just helping out with plenty of other practical and makeup guys.
Yeah. He was a gunslinger. He was a gun for hire for that kind of stuff, and that's what he did
best. What he did.
Yeah.
I'd even compare him to the guy who worked on Underworld who did some brief directing. He kind of was just one of those, hey, you would never see him dare bad talk any project, regardless of how he actually feels, because he's just glad to be in the business doing what he loves. So, yeah.
Right, and I'm usually effects guys are like that. And there's even, I mean, Nicotero made a bunch of fan films himself. Yeah. Nicotero did that too, and then like Kurtzman moved out to Ohio at one point when K&B kind of split up in the early 20-aughts, and like, you know, it didn't really split up, but the founding members just kind of went their separate ways, and I think Nicotero just kept running K&B as K&B, and the other guys just let him have the name. And like Kurtzman was like in Ohio making like, what was it, the Rage or the Surgeon or something, I can't remember what it was, but it was some like direct to video movie in the early 20-aughts, and he was kind of
Rage. I think you're right. He was trying that and some other one right around that point that was kind of another Friday the 13th-esque murder mystery.
Yeah, it was like a Camp Blood or something. Who knows what it was called.
Yeah, he was doing his own shtick because he had gotten Wishmaster in the first place by thanks to Sam Raimi putting in a good word for it, little known fact. And yeah, Nicotero was just kind of saying, well, okay, you guys can do what you want. I got this business, we founded, I'm going to stick with it. You know, I'm going to work on Walking Dead and all these other movies and shows.
And that was before Walking Dead came in, that they ended up splitting up, and he just kept running the company. I think the other folks were just tired of the grind of it. Like after a while, it became too much like a job, and that's why Berger and Kurtzman just kind of split, and Nicotero just stuck around and took it over. You know, I mean, I'm sure they still got residuals for the company or whatever it was, and they could have always come back. I don't think it was bad blood. I think it was just they got tired of the same shit every day, you know?
Yeah, and just so much work for, you know, sometimes you get a really good payday, other times you literally made it for peanuts, you know, and you described a bit of that when you were describing the Phantasm movies, how a lot of those guys were working on that. And it's like, that's fun, but again, you know, you can't always justify that every year. You know, you do got to try a few different things that you're comfortable doing, and that you got to do both what you love and you got to do financial security and what you're actually interested in. So, like you say, it's not like an unpleasant rock band split up. It's not at all like that. It's more like, here's what I'm going to do, here's what I'm going to do, and let's be consistent with our decisions from this point on.
Right. Now, what I kind of did with my criteria when I was watching these fan films, and like a way to not necessarily create a rating system, but more to come up with essentially a way to be like a sliding scale of a way to give folks an idea of what the quality was. And so I ended up choosing this on a Hellraiser debtor scale, right?
That's a good point to go. Yeah.
Okay. Cause debtor is like
a totally
kind of, movie. It's kind of like, it's kind of like sliding down the hill, you know, like Hellseeker had some moments, but was still just kind of, I mean, at least it had Kirsty back and, you know, we had the main actress that plays her back in there. And there were some interesting enough ideas.
You're going to hate me. That's the first one I saw.
That's fine. I mean, everybody comes at a series the way that they come at them, you know, like the first Stepfather movie I saw out of that franchise was the third one. And it's absolutely terrible.
Okay, there you go. Good segue. Because, yeah, it's like when they don't have numbers attached and the sequels are just more affordable, they end up playing those more on TV. And, you know, this, I've always been friendly to anything, whether it was made for TV, video store shelves, or actually got played in a theater. But yeah, I'm with you. Where Deader was kind of just like, just at the end of the tunnel, and that was before.
It's before the huge drop off, because the next ones and further on, like at least Deader had this like underworld going to investigate and trying to find some things, and it still felt like some things that they did in the comics like versions of Hellraiser. Movie.
Whereas, like, they have a reporter investigating supernatural happenings, and then it just took a totally different twist. But at least you could understand why, again, like, the other ones before, you know, were always kind of like Twilight Zone episodes with special guest star, you know, Pinhead and the Cenobites.
Yeah, the other, like, later ones that are after that, like, 6 is kind of like that, too, for sure. But 6 and 7 still feel like a Hellraiser movie, sort of. It gets really sandwiched in with, like, Hellworld and whatever the fuck the other ones were called. But yeah,
absolutely, because there was a good book that illustrated all the making of all the films up until Hellworld. Actually, I take it back. Maybe it was Revelations, but it came out around, I want to say, 2013, and it was a very cool book. I definitely recommend it. It gives you more backstory on the directors and writers involved and their intent, even how Peter Atkins got involved, you know, before doing other stuff. But yeah, Hellworld. And they even noted how it's like Lance Henriksen got involved because, hey, free vacation to Romania. And it was like the constant complaint was it feels like a Saw movie. And it was like 3 years that they made it before Saw. Like, well, someone must have been hearing someone else talk about it at Lionsgate or Dimension, because this is like, it's just doesn't feel like Hellraiser.
Yeah, well, the reason that I'm choosing the scale is, again, it's right before it gets really, really bad. And it's also the one that takes the biggest liberty with not really involving the box until like towards the very, very end and not really telling you what's going on. So like it's the least of a Hellraiser film that still feels the most like a Hellraiser film. So that's kind of like, you know, if it feels like a Deader, then it's cool. You know, like as far as the fan films go, is what I'm kind of getting at. And I tried to ignore the lack of budget, and I tried to ignore the lack of being able to act. But if you became overly pretentious and tried to do like serious hardcore Doug Bradley dialogue yourself as an actor for your Cenobites and like trying to make everything sound so profound and deep, chances are if you didn't get the right kind of actors, that did bring down my estimation of your film, and you're going to be half a Deader. But like, all I'm really looking for is for you to be at least like a Deader. And you only got to do that in like 5-10 minutes or 20 or 30. Some of them are a bit longer as well.
Right.
So that's kind of
have to stretch it out.
Right. That's how I did my criteria, was like, does it feel kind of like Deader to me? Because if
Revelations, where it's just so bad.
Oh yeah. That one's really, really terrible. That was literally just made to keep Dimension going. Like
it
to
was.
Own the rights, yeah. And then the very, very last one, Judgment or whatever, that one is very much just like a 90-minute fucking fan film for Hellraiser, because it's not really like Hellraiser at all. And the things that they changed and the things that they did that are different were kind of really interesting and felt more like the sort of stories they explored with the comic books and stuff. So I was kind of okay with that one as well. So, I mean, like Revelations and Deader would equal just right out. If you wanted to say it's about a Revelations or it's about a Deader, you know, I could totally see that, because they kind of have that equality to them. So I don't know, whenever you're ready, we could start digging into the films. You might have to refresh my memory and give me like a bit of a, not a plot synopsis, but like a brief, like this is what happened in it, so I can comment on it. Cause they're all melded together into one big giant casserole right now in my brain.
Absolutely. So the first known Hellraiser fan film that we could track down. There was a bunch of YouTube channels that were like dedicated. I don't even know if some of them had like connections to the other ones or were made by some of the same people. Some of them were, but like there was this one channel that like had all these various Hellraiser fan films and dedicated a website to it. And the first known one was from 1994 called Hellbent, a Hellraiser Chronicle. And I'm with Court, whereas like this one was like the first, you know, this was back when you either had film or a home video camera. And this was the case where they went with the latter, where they decided to show kind of a random takeover of a house and just people running around scared to death in the woods.
Was this the one where it was the British gentleman that was searching out and trying to find the box and was going out and grabbing people and stuff?
I thought that was part prophecy in 2006. Maybe it was more Lifebringer that you're thinking of.
Yeah, Lifebringer's the one that I'm thinking of. Yeah, so...
Yeah.
I told you I was going to get them all confused.
yeah, it's all good. So Hellbent, because I don't even know what the hell happened in that one. That one was... It was kind of both amusing, because I'm like, man, I miss it when everyone bullshitted with a camera at the same time. It was just like, the person just had no sense of coherentness, so it was a real turnoff. Hellraiser Chronicle.
Yeah, I'm going to okay, Hellbent, Hellraiser Chronicle. That was the three-part one, and it kind of started out with a bit of found footage.
He was a drug dealer, and he was, like, taking desperate measures, and I almost couldn't even find it at first, but it was fortunately on YouTube, and I wanted to watch it because it actually followed, like, two other fan films. it was followed by A Question of Faith and Lifebringer. So yeah, that's the mix up. But yeah, it's like it just reminded me almost of that So Bad It's Good movie that kind of became a Ken exploitation film, Things, but with kind of without any of the fun kind of hey.
Oh, you know? Yeah, that was the 4x3 one that was ultra fucking pixelated, and yeah, now I remember that one. Yeah, running yeah. around the woods. Okay, yeah, I can separate it with that one now. Yeah. That one is very much friends grabbed a video camera and made a Hellraiser dead film. Or a Hellraiser film, you know.
Like, totally.
Yeah, and they tried to... that one, I remember them trying to stick to the ethos as much as possible. They didn't change things around, but you could kind of tell they're just somewhat goofing off and having a good time, and I can't really fault them for that, but like...
Yeah, it was... I grinned a few different times. I had a shit-eating grin. I'm like, yeah, someone's having fun, but then after a while, I'm like, okay, now they're getting into a conversation, and I'm kind of feeling left out.
Yeah, they did okay with, if I remember correctly, they did okay with some of the lighting stuff. That's the one where, like, he's opening the box and there's a bunch of candles around and you can barely see what's going on with the video and the candle light and stuff. Right, okay. Yeah, I mean, and that stuff actually looked pretty eerie and they did the best they could with the equipment that they had. And I thought that was actually pretty interesting. But, I mean, this one is kind of like, I mean, this is just friends making a fucking movie. So this one is like, I mean, as far as, like, following the mythos stuff, it's definitely like an over a deader, but as far as like the quality, it's more like towards a Hellseeker.
Revelations.
Yeah, or Revelations, right? Because like they just didn't have the budget and they didn't have the money, and I'm not going to fault them for it, and they're not actors. So like obviously right. It's going to make it a more rough film, but for what it actually is, they follow the ethos enough and it is relatively enjoyable. Like you said, there's a couple things that gave me a chuckle or a smile, so... And I'm just going to start pulling these up on YouTube to look at them again while we're talking about them so I can refresh my
fine.
Mind.
No, that's fine. So the next one technically is in 2004. Makeup artist Gary J. Tunnicliffe kind of wrote a big kind of Dante's Inferno kind of speech. And he decided to put himself in makeup, play Pinhead, and write and direct. And this is like the shortest of it. It's only 6 minutes, and it's called, yeah, No More Souls, with the subtitle One Last Slice of Sensation.
This one is very much a dude that has tons of money and all the resources he needs and does all the makeup and all of that
it
kind of stuff.
It simplifies it. Like, Hellraiser, for the most part, is often, yeah, just one or two locations. It's the Romero handbook, you know. Two locations, you know, five actors, you know.
Take yeah, it just... away. Kiss, keep it short and simple. That's all you got to do. This one, I'm going to be a little bit more kind of critique on it, or at least a little bit more
it's not
critical.
Deep, but it's
Yeah, I mean, it's 6 minutes, and essentially the idea is really fucking cool. Like, what would happen if all life on Earth ceased because of nuclear war and Pinhead had no one to left to recruit? He would get that bored. Of course he would. I mean, like, you know, and the idea of having to wait for millions and millions of years for anything to be able to find the box and open it again that would be sentient enough for him to be able to get his pleasure. I get that idea. So mm-hmm. there's cool stuff here. And it's a really neat idea, but that soliloquy, and Truncliffe himself is not an actor, but like he's trying his heart out. And again, this is like, all right, so this is like a Nicotero level fan film where it's a guy who has the money, a guy who has the resources, a guy who can do this kind of stuff.
Could have gone to a SAG meeting.
Right, but he's putting himself in the film because this film is for him, man. This film is like, he's making this because he wants to do it, and it's literally just for fun for him, you know, and he just wants to kind of see what he can do with it and just have some fun, you know, and I totally get that. But like, because he had more money and he had the ability to do the crazy level of stuff that he did in this film for the 6 minutes that he did it in, I just kind of feel like he should have gotten himself at least someone that could pull Red off
sublines.
Or pulled off the Bradley Pinhead stuff just a little bit more or something, right? Like, and that's something that I need to reiterate about anyone who wants to make a film that's not just with their friends to have a good time. You want to actually make film that you want to get out there, that you want people to be able to judge your ability to make a film, and you want to be able to make another film off of that in any way, shape, or form. Get yourself some people who can actually fucking act. Local theaters are filled with people that you could use at probably a discounted or no rate at all, just absolutely, because they could use some real as well. I mean, I'm not the only one to say that, but like very specifically. Now, in the case of someone like Truncliffe here, who did this 6 minute short, I don't think he ever fully really intended anybody else to see this. He just kind of put it out there, and then the next thing you know, it kind of took off. You know?
I felt like he was trying to do kind of a sizzle reel. He wanted some funding, and he was going to eventually replace it with a bigger, more capable actor anyway. And that's so true, because, I mean, Doug Bradley was a theater actor. Paul Taylor was doing a lot of these kinds of shit hits the fan kind of terror films. I'm actually kind of pleased with the person who's attached to, like, the reboot, Jamie Clayton, because she can totally play unusual kinds of characterizations. So it's just like, that's what they're kind of going for. And I think with these fan films, with the people they pick for these, they need someone. Obviously, they can't afford even a theater talent, let alone someone other than a friend of a friend. So it's like they're just going for someone who can be spooky. And then, you know, Pinhead's voice is almost always done by someone like the filmmaker off screen, you know, in post.
Yeah, and in a couple cases, they actually dub in Bradley's voice from previous movies, which was
they
pretty
do.
Ingenious the way
music
they did it. Yeah.
Is taken. It is a fan film. This was before when there was even a bunch of fan film contests, and they had to follow certain criteria because the festivals were afraid of, you know, having a...
being sued.
Mm-hmm. Having a cease and desist order arrive at their doorstep. So I couldn't find No More Faith, but that was following the shot on video Hellbent. And but so the next one is technically Hellraiser Prophecy, probably the better known one. And this was split up into like three parts on YouTube. Lucifer from the Prophecy series of Christopher Walken films from Dimension Films comes to Earth to fight the Cenobites in this Prophecy Hellraiser crossover. And I'm kind of with you where the idea was just so awesome. And yet it was kind of just okay. Just due to there being more exposition than actual kind of happening. But yeah, the film, I kind of found the film's filming style and remaining cast kind of a turnoff, but it was still kind of cool when they actually got towards the end. If you can just spare your patience and get past some of the people reading their lines only a few times, you can really kind of dig, okay, I like this idea, because this is what I like about a fan film, where you can have there be a cool... kind of like with the superhero fan films, where you're going to have back people actually teaming up and, you know, doing an epic, you know, dick measuring contest where they're fighting each other.
Yeah, I think this one probably could have been shortened up with a little bit of editing.
22 minutes.
Yeah, it's 22 minutes, and really it's in two parts, and really the second part is really all you need in the film, you know?
I agree. He restated literally everything that was said at the start. It's like, so... that rendered the first part totally mute. You didn't even need those first 10 minutes.
Right. And I get it. The guy really, really loved Viggo Mortensen's Lucifer. And who doesn't? Like, that's kind of the best part of the prophecy when he shows really up and threatens to fill your mouth with the feces of your mother if you don't talk with him.
Yes.
Like, of course, who doesn't fucking love that Lucifer? He's one of the best on-screen cinematic devils ever. And he totally steals that film. Like, that's all I really think about. And Christopher Walken is a fucking revelation in that movie. And I still only think about Viggo Mortensen first. So I get why he picked the play Lucifer from The Prophecy. And I really like the idea that the angel war that's going on is basically what's allowing the Cenobites to do what they do, because neither one of these other realms are keeping them in check. And I like the idea that they came up with where Leviathan is a different hell, which they say they're in their own hell in the Hellraiser stuff. So he does tie it in that way, or whoever wrote it tied it in that way, totally. I would say.
The idea was so there, and it was clearly made by a movie buff, which is what you want in every fan film. You don't want someone who's just, you know, doing a cheap reenactment for a film studies class, you know, reenact the scene and do your own take on it. No, this was, hey, I grew up watching most of these movies. I like most of these movies, so I'm going to blend them together and see what I can do. And like you say, the only thing that was kind of missing was the kind of, like, I could tell that the guy playing Lucifer was inspired, but he just, it could have done like maybe one or two more rewrites. And I get it. Rewriting is hard because you got to factor that all in with shoot days and how you want to stage everything. So. Yeah, and I mean, yeah, Viggo, I mean, hell, we already did an episode on him. He's probably one of the more diverse actors in the industry today. And yeah, hell, when you even took on Texas Chainsaw Free, I was just like, yeah, he's a really awesome antihero in that movie. And in Prophecy, he really did steal the movie despite having virtually only two scenes.
yeah, and like less than probably 7 minutes of screen time, and yet he still becomes like this iconic cinematic devil. Now, one of the things that just to get back to this particular fan film, The Hellraiser Prophecy, the things that they definitely do right are the mashups, the ideas. And one of the things that I really dug is they actually go in with some of the comic books, and it looks like they're going with the Kirstie version of the person who runs
like
hell.
Comic book. Yeah.
Like in one of the comic series, Kirstie ends up somehow making some kind of a deal with Pinhead because Pinhead wants to no longer be in hell. Like, I can't remember exactly everything that happens, but she ends up reforming Leviathan's hell and kind of takes the job of like the lead Cenobite in a manner of making sure that things are done correctly. Like she accepts the fact that their type of hell is somewhat of a cosmic necessity for people that are seeking this sort of thing. But she wants to make sure that, like, in Pinhead's regime, they would take people just because. And in her regime, at least in the comics, from what I remember, it was more along the lines of you opened it because you knew what you were doing and you wanted to come. It's not you fucked up and you opened the box by accident and now we're going to extort you to get what we really want. You know?
Right. I think she always was kind of a devil in the details kind of person. And I'm with you there because, I mean, yeah, it made sense. That's kind of where the story had to go. And it makes sense that the comics, you know, they weren't sure, you know, what any good ideas that didn't make it into being made in a movie pretty much are in the comics. And it's like it makes sense that Kirstie could kind of navigate through hell. She's already had enough experience seeing how it's consumed both her parents, you know.
Well, I mean, her actual mom died way before the movie, and it was her stepmother, who was also a very wicked stepmother.
Right.
Now,
yeah.
It could also be that they're hinting at that this is Angelique, and somehow this is after, you know, the Hellraiser in space, and Angelique and the other Cenobites somehow survived, but Pinhead was destroyed. I don't know if that's what they're going for either. I'm really not sure. I was giving them the benefit of the
loose because
I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt and thinking that they did it because Kirstie eventually ended up taking over hell and that's what they wanted to do. And the idea of Pinhead getting bored with that as well, that's with hell that we were talking about in the last film, that was also kind of explored in that series too. The last thing I want to kind of mention as far as the crossover ability stuff with this specific one in The Prophecy, the
both
thing that they
film properties, yeah.
Right. Well, the thing that they did that actually kind of, It's before, I think, the Scarlet Gospels came out, but the Scarlet Gospels did something extremely similarly, where Leviathan's hell and the hell that the Christians know of as hell and all these other versions of hell, they all sort of exist in this same, like, nebulous realm. But it's sort of like this, like, realm of concepts in the Scarlet Gospels. Like, you can't really transpire from one end to the other. And so, like, Pinhead's in charge, and he's, like, the Hell Priest, but he's part of the Order of the Gash, and they have their own realm. And it kind of goes back to that, like, I can't remember exactly who proposed the idea, but there's, like, multiple princes of hell because they can't get their shit together, and everybody's always rebelling, or there's multiple kings of hell. And, you know, there's, like, all of these various factions, but, like, Lucifer somehow keeps them all together. You know, like that kind of like Christian mythology bullshit. Well, they kind of tie into that with the Scarlet Gospel stuff a little bit. And basically Pinhead has to work his way across that because he's done. He doesn't want to be Leviathan's bitch anymore. He just wants to move on.
He's in a different type of purgatory where it's like he basically his powers are now limited. And so now he just wants to. I mean, they've always kept it kind of mysterious how he's able to, you know, chain everyone up. But yeah, do those powers always equip, like we've seen him able to do it on Earth as well as in hell. So if he's in a kind of purgatory, if he's now restricted, he really isn't able to do much except just kind of taunt, you know?
Well, they do kind of, there's more stuff in the Scarlet Gospels I don't want to get into because we're not reviewing that. But like, it just, that's what this kind of reminded me of the ideas that they had, that there are multiple hells. But the idea that Lucifer is incapable of moving into Leviathan's realm and it's a completely different world, that's wholly theirs. And I really kind of like that idea that, like, he has to summon the minions of Leviathan for help with this war in heaven. Mm-hmm. Because he has no other option, so he kind of tricks a woman into doing it because her sister committed suicide and he'll let her soul out of hell for that or something along those lines.
Right, then he can torture her when she actually gets here.
Right. And so the she opens the box. They take her. He does nothing to help her because he's fucking Lucifer. Of course he doesn't. And then, like, they basically tricked him because they're fucking Cenobites. And that's the end of it. And then, like, the idea is that there's going to be this big epic battle to come, you know, between the Lucifer version of or the prophecy version of Lucifer and this angel war. And then so basically the idea is Lucifer's going to have a good old time being ripped apart and, you know, all of this awful stuff is going to happen to him in Leviathan's hell, but they're all still going to team up after this is over. So it's kind of like this kinky sex thing that Lucifer's about to get into with the Cenobites, where he's like, yeah, I got time to knock one out, why not, and then we'll go fight.
I totally forgot about that. Yeah, because I mean, and even just you do see a lot of the BDSM kind of just art direction, I think, briefly on one of the walls. It's just like, yeah, this is his dungeon. He'll do whatever he wants to. Yeah.
Yeah, they came up with some really great ideas, and they made really good uses of some of the cheaper costumes, like the Butterball and stuff like that. They brought back the iconic characters as best they possibly could. Acting wise, this is, again, just got your friends together level of acting. And if any of the folks that were in that film are actually, like, you know, consider themselves actors, like actors and are, like, trained actors and getting paid gigs and stuff like that, more power to you, because in this film you did not do that well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not trying to be rude, I'm not trying to, like, hurt your feelings, I'm trying to give you a fucking critique here. The acting in this was really bad. It was really, really bad. But the ideas were great, the things they were trying to do were really cool, and everybody's really giving it their all. So this is basically,
sure,
like,
nice people,
right? Story-wise, they're going pretty much deader with it. Like, they're right at deader. I'm happy with that. But we're back to a little bit of revelations with the acting and stuff. It's real subpar.
Yeah,
we're gonna keep
We're gonna keep critiquing the acting because it did seem like a lot of them could have been great, but they didn't do as many takes, or they picked a lesser take, or, like you say, a lot of them just didn't have enough training and stamina, and just clearly had something else on their mind besides, hey, let's just get this done and give it our best shot. Yeah. And I find that sometimes, even if you're not an actor, if you can still have some kind of public speaking or confidence level to where you're ready to kind of maintain everyone's attention, all eyes on you, you can do kind of a cool job, especially if you just need 20 minutes to get a good take. But yeah, there are plenty of these where it just feels like, yeah, I'll see you in class on Tuesday and let's pick your brain and see how you can do better.
Right. And I think particularly this is the one that I was thinking of when the lead Cenobite that's supposed to be either like Kirstie from when she becomes the leader in the comics or the Angelique, because that's the only one that's left after Pinhead was destroyed, whichever it's supposed to be, that particular actress could not carry the gravitas with which the lines were trying to be delivered.
Was she the one in Part Three?
Yeah, the final bit that, or the, no, the,
on Hell on Earth, or you're talking Part Four when he's in space.
Angelique is the one from Part Four when he's in space. She's the one that that was like the demon summoned in the ancient times of the box.
Yeah.
Well, I'm actually talking the actress in the Hellraiser Prophecy, who I couldn't tell which her character was.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay.
No, that one, that actress in Hellraiser 4 who plays Angelique did an amazing job in Hellraiser 4. I really liked it. And she kind of stole a lot of the scenes that she was in for me. But I'm talking specifically. Girl, yeah. Yeah, I'm speaking specifically of in the Hellraiser fan film Prophecy in Part 2.
Her now. Yeah, I couldn't tell if she was the exact same character or if she was a different Cenobite, but that makes better sense that they were trying to recreate that same character from that, and she seemed to just kind of, like you say, it's like she was just saying the lines but not becoming the character, and it was just painful to watch.
Yeah, and I mean, she definitely was not an actress. You could tell it just wasn't something that she had done before, and you know, the filmmaker made the decision that he made. And again, it's just a freaking fan film. I'm not trying to be cruel about it. I'm just saying, like, critique wise, that's some of the weaknesses of the film. Like, the other stuff I really, really liked. I mean, the shots were pretty well composed. They did an excellent job with what they put together with what they had. Absolutely. And,
yeah.
You know, like you said, the background S&M stuff, you know, kind of made me wonder where a lot of these ideals came from. But
I think they were watching Hellworld, but they were a big Barker fanboy. And so they decided we're going to make that better than that movie, because that movie was basically just a softcore porn with gore. You know, and we don't want to go there. We want to show the kinky, but we don't want to become an actual, you know, pornographic nature. You know,
that's a possibility. Yeah, I'm ready to move on from this one, though. But this one was not so bad. I'm just being a little bit more critical of it because the acting kind of hurt for as long as it was.
It was painful. And it was one of those, had it not had that awesome idea, it would have become kind of unsustainable after a while. But
absolutely.
We digress. So Life Ringer, this follows again, though. I don't know if it was by the exact same people, but it apparently followed the events of the shot and camcorder Hellbent from 94 and The Question of Faith, which we couldn't find a link for, from 05. And this was made in 2009. And as a refresher, Hellraiser Lifebringer, just how to describe it. This was the one with the surgeon who wanted to give the gift of life. If that rings a bell, he was.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
This had a very slow build up. And so it was very hard to follow at first. And I thought it was like, okay, well, part of Hellraiser is it's a waiting game. You're waiting for, some brooding evil to kind of take its course. And this was one I had to just say, whoa, what's going on here? There's some people looking at him, watching him. What is that building up to? What does that have to do with Hellraiser?
It was kind of interesting. This one in particular, the Hellraiser Chronicles Lifebringer, where it's the British guy who's basically born with life, and he gets involved with the bike. Yeah. Or he gets involved with the box, like he buys it off of somebody and all that. That specific one is very, very much like a one-off Cenobitic story that I think Mike Mignola wrote in. It's one of the Hellraiser comics that I have, where it's like these little vignettes, where it's like individual little stories that were just like one shots or like maybe one comic.
He the guy who did Hellboy? Right?
Yeah.
So there you go. Yeah.
Well, his particular story was very similar to this in that there was a guy who was like looking to do better or be more than what they were, and it wasn't necessarily that they were a surgeon. I can't remember exactly what it was, but they opened the box, and rather than get brought in and turned into a Cenobite just fucking hangs out with the guy and directs what he's doing and kind of gives him the knowledge that he's seeking and just kind of nudges him a little bit and just kind of entices him and plays like the old fashioned, not possession, but sort of like summoning a demon type of game where they give you the knowledge. And as long as you don't get in hell's way, you keep the magic and that kind of stuff. And that's totally very much what this reminded me of. You know, it was it was real interesting that they went that route with it. And I like that they took a completely different Cenobite, because this is just his own personal Cenobite who's feeding him information and trying to help him with this surgery thing that he's trying to do. You know, and he's depressed. He lost his mother and father, and he's got all the ability to make money, but he, as a doctor or whatever, and he just doesn't do it as far as what I could gather. And then his sister's tired of him being a fucking layabout and is constantly in his face about shit because she wants their parents' house all to herself, I guess. I mean, like, I'd start hanging out with a fucking Cenobite and operating on people against their will, too, if I were him.
Yeah, yeah. I like how these guys were clearly hardcore fans of the original movie, at least. It, you know, just had that same kind of personal befallen tragedy and someone's in a secluded, you know, upstate house. And like you say, it's like their personal life is in shambles, and they're just that's enough of the turning point where, like, we all know this is where Pinhead and the Cenobites are going to prey on this guy. And the acting and film style, I actually was very impressed by. They definitely had that down to a T.
Yeah, I didn't like our main actor as much, but the supporting cast was surprisingly good, particularly the sleazy greaseball guy that's like selling him the box. That guy was just a joy when he was on screen. And the person in this Cenobite outfit that was doing the physicality did an excellent job. It was obviously not the same voice, because I don't know if people know this or not, but with that kind of makeup, you're not going to be able to fucking talk through it. No. That's why that voice was dubbed. If it's the same actor that's doing the voice dub after the motions, then great. But the two paired well together. And in a fan film, that was extremely surprising. Like, when the person was talking and, you know, you heard the dubbed voice talking and the Cenobite was emoting or doing its motions on screen to, like, go along with it, it actually matches up pretty freaking well. And I was really impressed with that. For this being a fan film, and they definitely, whoever made this definitely has some reel here where they can be like, okay, so these are obviously some non-actors and I could do better with this stuff, but here's my shots, here's my composition, here's my editing, you know, this makeup was done by, you know, someone that I can rely on to be able to give me this level of quality makeup or better. You know, obviously we can't do Hellraiser because, you know, suing, but, you know, like, I could totally see where someone could take this and try and shop it around as like a first film that, you know, here's what I made on no money, you know.
And with you, I would not be surprised if, you know, I mean, I'm sure they seemed like the kind of guys who were constantly just even studying themselves. You're like, we can do this better. Okay, we don't have time for this, but we got to spend more time on this. You know, we got to get the mood, we got to get the tone, we got to get the makeup. Otherwise, you know, we can just call it. This is kind of like, I feel like they're trying to at least be like Tunacliff, where they're trying to do a sizzle reel regardless of what they do with this project afterwards, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And this one kind of really does have some potential to it, and you can see some serious talent here, and all the people that are in it could probably use their scenes for reels if they really wanted to, except for maybe some of the people that were playing the bodies being operated on. They're not going to get much for playing a corpse for real, but, you know, up until that point, sure, why not? But yeah, this one definitely, I mean, as far as following the storyline, this actually does better than A Debtor. It actually goes to at least about 4, where it's trying to expand the mythology on its own, and it also feels like it's tapping into the stories in the comics, the way that the Cenobites work in the comics, where they can expand the universe and do some various things too. And there's a lot of little like winks and nods in this one, specifically the parts that I kind of vaguely remember various stories I read in the comics beyond just the Magnolia one that I mentioned as well. So totally.
A voyeuristic feel from this. Like, he's always constantly being watched. That's why he's always looking over his shoulder.
Well, I always got the sensation that the Cenobite was always with him and no one else but him could see it. And that's why he was always looking over his shoulder. That's what I thought.
It even more powerful. And I mean, kudos to the music too. It gave us that sense of kind of paranoia. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, there's something that's driving him forward, whatever that was and whatever it was that they were trying to make. That's how I interpreted it, was that the Cenobite was always talking to him and he would just look back. you know, like, okay, yeah, that's what I'm going to do next. And then you go do it. Like, I think he was being directed the entire time.
Totally. And I feel like Clive Barker might even give this some applause, saying, hey, at least you get my formula, you know, regardless of where you are as a filmmaker, you know?
Yeah, and he actually, he's very positive about most of the fan films. He really likes people going after and trying to expand the universe and stuff like that. Like, I've not really seen stuff where he's like, oh my God, that's awful, to people, you know, where he still tries to be encouraging in some ways to his fans, which
is
pretty
awesome.
His
fan base is all he has left. You know, he's burned every bridge. He's much like, I would compare him to J. Michael Straczynski of Babylon 5. You know, he's just so sick of dealing with investors and studio heads to where he's just like, it's not worth it anymore. You know, if you want to adapt my stuff, I better have some kind of say before I give it to you. You know?
Yeah, well, and I can totally see that happening to any writer, really, you know, that has such a vast source of material to work from. I mean, that's why he became a director in the first place, was because he was tired of how people were fucking up his stuff. So, and, you know, the fact that he would be encouraging, and like I said, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I've seen him be encouraging about fan films when he was aware of them. And there's like an article that I saw about it where he kind of reviewed some of them and talked about his thoughts about them, you know. And
oh, really?
He was a little bit more positive about some of them than what I was. I don't know. I don't remember what films they were, obviously, but. And he does talk about the later Hellraiser films, too, in interviews or two. So,
yeah, I some of them he probably hasn't even seen. He was like, yeah, you didn't involve me. Fuck you. So, yeah, but I know what you mean. He does take pride in the fan base. And I think at this point he even wants to just move on. He wants to adapt some of his other stuff with the right person. But it's just near impossible to find the right person and get the right kind of cut, you know, down to a T. So
yeah, Mike Flanagan needs to hook up with Barker, and let's see what we can get for series out of the two of them.
Him, Scott Derrickson, maybe even someone else who just most people can probably agree. I know. Well, I shouldn't say that. Derrickson already did Part 5, but that was his. That's why he went on to do similar stuff like Sinister and all that. So yeah, get Flanagan, get someone else even who just, I mean, I kind of have a good feeling about Hulu, because, I mean, they already did Books of Blood, which got some mixed but decent reviews. So I was like, OK, well, I kind of have a better feel with this. Otherwise, if it's still with HBO, I can totally see them doing a good anthology show, kind of like Tales from the Crypt, but totally grim and serious as opposed to darkly humorous.
Yeah, I mean, the Hulu's Books of Blood was relatively OK. There's some folks that took cracks at the story of Books of Blood, or the idea of Books of Blood, where there was actually just a film called Book of Blood, and it was moderately okay as well. It's real difficult to adapt stuff from Books of Blood, because Barker was really swinging for the fences on that one. You know, like in those books of, like, those short stories and that sort of stuff, it was just him writing for him, and then they got published and then they got huge.
It's hard to create a narrative where you get, make the author happy, make it work as a movie, make it work as an adaptation, make it work as just how many visual effects will be needed, how big a crew will you need. You know? Yeah.
Well, there's that, and then there's also the very simple fact that they actually, in Books of Blood, it's supposed to be like an anthology. It's a bunch of individual little stories, and whenever you try to do a wraparound story to make that work, I mean, the wraparound story of the person having everything scribbled on them, that was in the first Books of Blood, and that explained what they were supposed to be. And then from there on out, it's just the individual stories, and you don't even think about the original wraparound story again. And that one tried to do sort of like the trick or treat sort of thing with these interwoven stories where you're weaving in and out of these different times. And I think that's really what hurt it. I think what they should have done with Books of Blood is just done the movie where it's the guy that becomes the book of blood. And then from there on out, you can open the series with her reading another story, and then it goes into it or whatever. And they could have done it a little better than that. But it's because they tried to interweave it and make all the stories match together that it just didn't really work, is the problem there. And wow, there's your review for Books of Blood on Hulu.
There you go. I know what I'm in for now.
And it's actually not bad. I mean, I did enjoy it, but it does have its flaws, absolutely. And it's not really an adaptation of Barker stuff.
Gotcha. Oh, mixed bags. Where would you be without it? So we did Lifebringer the same year as Lifebringer in 2009. There was Deader Winter's Lament, which again follows Hellraiser Prophecy by mixing in, once again, the Prophecy and Hellraiser universe, and it takes place after the actual canon film Hellraiser Deaders. So, much like you, I dug the ideas. I thought the pacing and acting was more believable here, but it still kind of had a few small rough spots, but it was good as a fan film, I thought. But I'll let you weigh in.
Okay, Winter's Lament was a bit rougher for me.
It was at times here and there. I dug the payoff, but getting there much once again, you're either not going to like it or.
Yeah, this was three parts. Each of them were about 10 to 15 ish minutes or so. And really, I mean, you had maybe a 17 minute story in what they were trying to do. The opening of the Winter's Lament, Dead or Winter's Lament or whatever it was really kind of interesting. I mean, it's a prequel. It's supposed to set up what starts this cult, and they're trying to explain how this cult would come to be and how the box were to happen. Because, I mean,
still when suffers from exposition, but right, it's when not
you come,
too bad.
When you come into the world of Deader as the actual movie Deader, not this fan film that's the prequel, you are just kind of dropped into this world that is very much not a Hellraiser world. And what this film is trying to do is just kind of ease you into that horseshit that they're pulling on you.
I agree. It did kind of feel like a teaser versus an actual any kind of complete work in any kind of sort of way. It might as well have been kind of an alternate mirror universe for that matter, because I might find that more interesting even.
And if I recall stuff in Deader as best I can, because I've only seen that about like three times, but there's a lot of talk in the exposition on how that cult kind of got started, where some people are telling you bits and pieces of some of the stories. But it's not like a complete thing. And this film, from what I can remember, follows that stuff pretty fucking closely. Like, you know, so clearly they were someone who liked Deader when they did this. I mean, otherwise, why would you make a prequel to Deader? And the ideas that they're throwing in here are great. But like you said, there's an excessive amount of exposition. I mean, just because dialogue is cheap to shoot doesn't mean that your film should always be nothing but dialogue. I mean, and voiceovers. Oh my God, voiceovers are the fucking worst. And if you're making a fan film and you're using a lot of voiceover to explain what you're showing on screen, like where the guy's talking about how he's doing all the research while we're watching him sitting on the floor playing with the box, it's like, no, don't need this. Just cut to him at a library, and I'll make the leap in my own logic there. We don't need any of this. And it's just kind of like. A more inexperienced filmmaker and or storyteller telling you the parts about how the meal is made, not the fact that it's poisoned and that's what's going to kill the person.
They're not more
focusing
like
on what matters is what I'm getting at.
Oh, hell, this is like one of those Marvel one shots or just side stories, a prologue that would often come out when you got a TV show of a DVD and you had like a little small like 5 minute short that you watched in order to get hyped up for the next season. Shows like Battlestar Galactica, Lost, and 24 were like the kings of doing that for quite the longest time, even Prison Break. And it's like, but like you say, it's not even a complete work, and it's well intended, but it is made by people who kind of just throw in a bunch of first time stuff that just is very distracting from any kind of narrative standpoint. It's like, I get it. What you can't show, but you want to talk about and let people in on, you should use a voiceover, but not just to the point where you're like, okay, and I know enough now. And I think another big thing that it took me a while to get into is none of the actors look at all like any of the characters like from Deader or the Prophecy that they're portraying. I'm like, whoa, okay. So I'm even more confused now. You might as well just had to been standalone.
Well, I was actually kind of thinking that they were, other than the cult leader guy was supposed to be the cult leader guy still, and some of the people that were in the cult were supposed to be the cult. I was going to let that go because I'm like, he's probably gone through a bunch of fucking members before he got it right.
Yeah, he probably had a few actors who were perfect, but they refused to show up.
Well, and I meant like the cult leader himself probably went through some people before he actually got people coming back from the dead and using the box in ways it wasn't intended. But let me back up. The movie itself or the fan film itself, it has a really great opening, and that sort of found footage thing that they were doing where the camera is filming them and then they get attacked and then, you know, the camera's destroyed.
I forgot about that. Oh my god.
Yeah. But like that opening was actually pretty solid, and I'm like, all right, cool, found footage Hellraiser flick, let's see what these folks are doing. And then they completely abandoned that, and I'm like, oh man, you had something there. Like, I was willing to let everything else go. I'm like, of course it looks shitty, it's somebody that shouldn't be at a fucking cult meeting where they get summoned, and wait, those are scientists, but wait, scientists are fucking with the box. Oh, what's this mean? You know, like, I was asking all these questions and I was super interested in it, and then it just kind of, they threw that to the wayside, and it's about this guy doing the research and explaining how he develops the Deader cult, you know. And it kind of I don't know, the longer that went on, the more sad I got, and the more I wanted to see some of the found footage idea for the Hellraiser flick, you know, because that's ripe for that kind of stuff, because dumb Fox would try to Instagram this new wonderful toy box that they're trying to open.
Before the internet,
the hell. Right, like that totally could fucking happen. Dumbasses would do that shit now. So like, I'm buying into that as far as, you know, found footage stuff goes. You know, like I kind of like that idea of a Hellraiser film that has like some found footage aspects to it where you see that. You know, that idea was really cool. And I'm gonna give the makers of Hellraiser Deader, Winter's Lament, you know, plenty of leeway for the rest of the stuff that I got complaints about, just because that initial idea really kind of grabbed me and I liked where they were going with it.
Well, yeah, I'm with you. It's again, like all these other ones, there's some pros and cons in each, because how can there not be? You know, they know what they want to make. It's just they make simple mistakes that, you know, any first time student is going to make, you know. And again, you kind of I am kind of with you, where it's kind of rough watching them at first. And then at the end, you're like, well, I'm still kind of glad I watched it, because at least I saw something that was made by a fan who loved this universe. But at the same time, you know, it could still be so much better. But it's saved by the fact that it's a fan film.
Right. Like, I'm going to be a lot more lenient on anyone who is shooting a fan film than I am someone who is trying to shoot a film that they're trying to sell me. Like, where I have to pay.
Yeah. And I got into arguments all the time with snobs who were like, I want my project to look like Del Toro, Spielberg, Chris Nolan. And it's like, it's not gonna. You don't have that time or money or even equipment, you know? And so just be you. And I noticed a lot of the guys who just didn't do so well at film school were just ones who just, they could have a great script or just a decent one that they could build upon. They could storyboard, have a shot list. And if they still didn't like what they said, just their heart instantly just dropped. And I'm like, that seems pretty silly to just drop everything you're doing just because you couldn't get one particular shot in. You know, it's like, I just don't see how you could want to just throw everything all away just because, you know, we didn't have time for that one shot that was really just extended eye candy. You know, that was really just one cool thing that doesn't really necessarily have anything to do with the narrative.
Well, filmmaking is really a difficult undertaking. The odds are insurmountably against you. From the start of any project like that,
yeah.
No matter what you're trying to do, even for a fan film, if you set out to shoot a short film and you successfully complete it, good work. You already did better than so many other people out there that like just armchair direct and bitch about the shit that you put together. You absolutely did. If you work on a project and it doesn't get finished, but you give it your all and you have some moments that you can kind of share of like some reel of what you got or some dailies of what
you learned from it. It was already a good shoot.
Right. Like, I mean, film is always destined to fail. When it doesn't fail, it's because of sheer dumb luck or just the right kind of timing or just something worked out or everything just fell into place. Because of every single one of even the fan films that we're talking about, there's 100 more that never got finished. And there's 100 more that never even got started. And then there's 100 more that never got around to the next bull pass when someone came up with the idea of it.
Yeah, there was probably a jealous fan. And then they're like, well, you guys kind of had echoed a lot of my same ideas, so why bother? You know? And then there was probably another guy who's like, damn, you're good. I could never be as good as you. Or, oh, I could be better as you, but I don't have the time or patience. Or, you know, I'm just shit talking. So,
right. And I kind of like the idea of checking out these very much amateur filmmakers, a few of them like Truncliffe became a filmmaker and actually made films and was directing beyond just doing the effects for stuff after his little sizzle reel for No More Souls. And that one so far has been the most professional with the largest budget.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Was he involved with Prophecy or with this one? I thought he was involved with one of the other ones.
What, Truncliffe?
Yeah.
No, he's
okay, the one he acted in. Okay.
Yeah, Truncliffe was just the I think he ended up directing. Did he direct Judgment?
Yes,
Hellraiser
did.
Actual Hellraiser Judgment. I think that his No More Souls was essentially a way for him to show that he could handle Judgment.
Oh yeah, you can totally feel like he kind of intended that with Revelations, but since that one was, you know, hired by dirt cheap people, it was almost like Texas Chainsaw. They kept going for people who wanted to do music videos but had no sense of, couldn't keep their egos in check and couldn't perform any kind of coherent vision unless it was, again, yeah, a music video or just a brief commercial.
Oh, I didn't realize that he was part of that one too.
Yeah, he did the original script, but they didn't follow any of it because they only shot it in like 2 weeks for like $2,000.
Oh, he wrote it and then somebody else severely fucked it up. I'm understanding what you picked up. Okay, I'm picking up now what you were placing down. I apologize.
No, oh God, Revelations. That's why they pretty much, this is like, that's how desperate and why we don't respect it. It's like they had all the time and the money in the world and they just disrespected just everything as a movie. But yeah, he got his second shot by doing Judgment and he got some kind of mixed bag of opinions because it's like it's part Saw, it's part Hellraiser, and then I knew so many people who, again, they kind of do what they do with the crime shows or a sitcom. If a popular actor doesn't return with it, they don't want any part of it. And I saw so many who just refused to watch it just because, oh, Doug Bradley refused to return. I'm like, well, you should still kind of check it out just to see what you think of it, you know, as a standalone. But I'm with you where it is kind of a mixed bag. But I think it's good that Tunnicliffe has gotten a chance to interact with fans, do his fan film, and then actually get a chance to continue with the franchise despite so many people leaving afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, as far of a drop as what Revelations was, his film was enough of a pick-me-up to where I'm like, all right, you're back to like direct-to-video shittiness at least with what you're doing here. But at least it's a competently made film. At least there's some new ideas that they're trying to do. And the reason that I mention it is because to me, Judgment is very much a Hellraiser fan film because there's a lot of stuff where he put in ideas, or they, I should say, whoever, the filmmakers put in ideas that were very much out of the comics, that were very much out of some of the Order of the Gash ideals that were in Scarlet Gospels, that were very much in that universe that was being used before or was hinted at. And the things that people were saying about like the different Cenobites that have all of these different jobs, they must have forgot about the giant penis brain monster, like brain eating monster that took over Shinar to go around hell in Hellraiser 2. Like, what other purpose did that thing have? So saying that there are
the Doom type beast in part 4, you know?
Right. And just the Hellraiser like hall monitor monster thing that's like the giant aborted fetus in the original Hellraiser. Like, what else was that thing's job other than to just like monitor that like corridor?
Hellraiser is a better version of Spawn, basically, you know.
Well, it was their first, right?
It was their first, but you look at how successful that cartoon was compared to any live action version. It was just like, there's just some stuff that's just easier to illustrate, no pun intended, and like you say, show that, again, everybody in hell is basically some kind of mutant hybrid or just a servant to the other demons that live there, and they're all disfigured. They could never have any place on Earth or be accepted just because of their looks, even, you know?
Well, and more importantly, Cenobites are designed specifically for a function. They are designed specifically, even in the Hellbound Heart, the original novella, there are Cenobites that are created out of however they're made. It doesn't really say in the Hellbound Heart, but their specific purpose is they are there for the carnal physical pleasures of what a human would normally want to sensate, only it's amped up to the beyond to where it almost becomes painful. So like, there are actual Cenobites that are designed to fuck, like for
pain
real.
For pleasure, yeah.
Right, Mike. And it's not always just about the ripping you apart and you know, that I mean, that's very much a part of it. They still do rip you apart and they still do. Basically, they take your nerve endings beyond the point of all understanding. And because you're with them, you don't die. And that's kind of what ends up happening is you become this intense experience forever.
Yeah, it almost even kind of reminds me. Just of all those other kind of fantasy elements, like think of the Prince of Persia without the ability to reverse time in those games, you end up that you follow the same fatal journey that all the other heroes before him did. And yeah, with all these demons, yeah, they otherwise have no other purpose. But with when they're all combined together, they basically, yeah, they all kind of just do various measures of the seven deadly sins. And yes, they to get right, like, off on pain.
And that's what that judgment actually did pretty well is they had specific Cenobites that the only reason that they existed were these weird jobs inside of this house. And what they were essentially doing is the box wasn't working anymore. They weren't getting enough people. So the idea was they started setting up these extreme haunt kind of things where you would come in and you would get these extreme experiences. And they still kind of tricked people into it with the same thing. And the idea is the desire to open the door. So they go into the house, but there's still a way that they have to figure out how to get in. It's the exact same kind of thing. Yeah, and then they turn it into a Minotaur maze. I don't fault them for the way they went about doing the things that they did with that particular film. And again, the reason I'm reviewing it, because as far as I'm concerned, it's a goddamn fan film too.
We didn't even get to it when we did our whole franchise breakdown because we were just suffering through all the other bad ones that we were ranting about. But, fun fact, the one guy with glasses was at Tunnicliffe is such a film buff, he even admitted that guy was inspired by Ben Kingsley's accountant in Schindler's List. He had a few other Easter eggs, other movies he grew up loving.
Well, and that makes sense. You know, someone who actually is keeping track. Hell is supposed to be super ordered in Pinhead's world, so of course they would have accountants. And as far as I'm concerned, an existence where a pencil-pushing bean counter is in control of everything is very much hell. So I thought it fit.
Yeah, it's a good symbolism for, you know, it's just like people who do the jobs that no one else wants to do, but actually keep everything, you know, on time and on budget. And in this case, it keeps everyone in line in hell.
And the angelic presence that ends up showing up in that one as well, that ties in with some of the way, because there is like, I can't remember what they are referred to as, but there's like a heaven version of Cenobites that are like these engineered angels that are not necessarily built for battle. And then in the comic books, there's like a human version that they're called Harrowers, where they have a special power that like they're born with some kind of ability to naturally fight Cenobites, and they actually summon them to kill them. And like it's a comic book, so it's very much like they're supposed to be superheroes, like a Doom Patrol that fights Cenobites. And so the ideas that they had with adding that angel and all that stuff, that there's precedence for that, too. I don't know why people were bitching about that, but they did.
I think it was how it was introduced. It made sense for its purpose and everything. It's just I think because everyone was already underwhelmed by how it started off as a Saw movie. And then it kind of went back to being like Inferno, where it's a Seven type mystery and the detectives aren't yet in on the clue that, you know, this is not a killing by a human, you know. And I think that's just it. It was like three different movies mashed together. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I agree. The angelic presence has a purpose. It's just the transitions in between those is just very kind of rough. So you're just kind of not used to just switching your brain and just saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, I got to watch this one more time and get in the mood and figure out what's going on. But
I could see that. But I don't view it as, I mean, obviously.
It's not a flaw. It's not a con. It's just getting there.
It was a fucking fan film to me either way. Like that's, and I'm not going to, I'm like, yeah, it's rough. Yeah. They didn't give enough money to the guy to be able to do it. They probably should have just skipped Revelations, thrown a bunch of money at him to do the judgment. And maybe he could have done a little bit more with it. I mean, like he shot it in a house in fucking Bulgaria for fuck's sake is what it looks like. Who cares? They didn't have the goddamn money. You know, they made it work.
They did not. I better ask you, were you able to see Origins, that one proof of concept trailer?
Yeah, it was like that little short 2-minute one. I don't remember it off the top of my head.
But it was, I'm kind of like one of the other ones. It wasn't really a complete film because, yeah, it's a proof of concept that someone.
Right. This is a new Cenobite gets developed, or a new Pinhead or whatever is supposed to be.
Yeah, mostly all CGI animated, and it's pretty cool for what it is. But
yeah, yeah. And they show the hell. That is another one that reminded me very much of the stuff that's in the Scarlet Gospels, where like he's trying to not necessarily take over all of hell, but is trying to get the power to do the thing that he's trying to accomplish. I don't want to spoil it completely.
It's a cool character arc that you would have liked to seen all the other sequels kind of do, but they could never do that. They wanted to, again, kind of make Pinhead be like Freddy Krueger, where he's terrorizing people, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting what they ended up doing. It was a really cool idea, and I liked the concepts that they had. Some of the CG was a bit rough, but not terrible, and what they had and what they did with it worked rather well with me and for me. And I liked the weird sort of Roman centurion looking fucking Cenobite guy that we're following.
I did
that.
See that a lot. I was like, yeah, these guys are inspired by more than just all other kinds of mythological history that they've grown up listening. You know, I was almost inspecting even kind of some Norse god to drop from the sky. You know?
Yeah, and this one definitely looks like the kind of, this is someone who was, it's a passion project, but they spent some money on it because the shots are excellent. The acting is actually pretty passable for a fan film. It's definitely above.
And this is narration done right.
Yeah, they got somebody that could, they got somebody that knows what they're doing for that, as a matter of fact. Yeah, but even just the physicality of some of the minions that they showed, that there are actual other people that are in the film whenever he's in the hellscape and stuff. I mean, that even those motions looked like people that were really trying to give it their all and make it believable with all the stuff going on in the background when he stands up. And the CG stuff was enough to make me buy what was going on. And the thing was over within 2 minutes, and it had me wanting to see more. It definitely got me like, yeah, it definitely got me like, what the fuck else could these folks do? You know, so
it must have not shown it to enough people. It's like, show this to someone at a convention, have them pick a producer's, you know, number, you know.
Right, like even if you don't make a Hellraiser film, like at least you got the ability to do a lot with very little budget, you know, however much you spend on this. And the less you spend on it, the more impressed I am at the end result, totally. More or less. Yeah. And I think that's the last one, right? I don't remember watching any of
those. Remember What's Your Pleasure is the final one from 2010.
Oh, shit. Yes. Okay. We did have Your Pleasure. Yes.
And this, I was very shocked before you weigh in. I was very shocked at how lowly rated this was, because I kind of found the beginning very suspenseful with a moody electronic score and great makeup, and I just thought the payoff at the end with the Hell Gateways and the other S&M kind of looking stuff were just really intriguing to me. Like, I got my money's worth just with what I saw on screen for a fan film. It was just, like, you can't even tell if the chains are CGI or practical, but you're impressed because you feel the impact. And I was really creeped out by the crying baby echoes when the main protagonist is crawling through the hallway.
That sounded like they lifted it from in Hellraiser 2. There were crying baby sounds in the background in the hallway.
They sped up the sound effect, yeah.
Well, and I love that this is the one where they dubbed Doug Bradley's voice, and they just had the back of Pinhead's head, where it was somebody that was pretending to be Pinhead. And I thought that was interesting as well.
Save yourself the trouble hiring actors.
Yeah, this one is where the lady just opens the box without knowing what it is. And that was like my biggest issue that I had with it. It's like the guy that gave her the box was trying to kill her by, you know,
by a Cenobite. That was a questionable intent. And I think that's just it. They just wanted to just kind of speed up the process and get on with the show, I think. But yeah, that for the 5 minutes that like that happens, you're like, whoa, hey, you know, don't you know better? I guess no one ever learns.
And while I liked that they showed a true body suspension and did include that in the film,
good,
like someone
shadowing of what's about to come.
right like I felt like that was what they were trying to do, but my god, they focused in on the actual process of it like way too much. I mean, like,
I mean, that's too long.
It's like, yeah, do we really need to watch her swing like for another 2 minutes? You know, like, can we just get the point? Do we really need to watch each individual hook being pushed into this person? I get it. You must have paid for this suspension in order to get this into your film, and you want to use as much as you possibly can. But it pushes it into sort of an exploitation realm to film an actual suspension to put into your Hellraiser film. You know, like none of the other fan films kind of went that direction. They all still did it with special effects. And, you know, even though they may have had their own S&M gear in the background, you know what I'm saying? But like this specific one, and I don't want to make it sound like I have an issue with people who do suspension. It's your fucking flesh. You put as many hooks in it.
Believe it or not. Type stuff. Yeah.
You put as many hooks in it as you feel is possible, and you suspend yourself all you fucking want. You enjoy that all you want. You get the spiritual experience you have from that all you want. That's absolutely fine. My fault here is, and my issue here is, you're trying to do foreshadowing for the story, and it's probably less expensive for you to just film an actual real one, sure, but you held on it long enough to where it started feeling like a exploitative, look at how twisted this can be part for your short, and it took up the bulk of your runtime, and it really just kind of took me out of it. I mean, the film does win me back over whenever she does finally open the box and all of that kind of stuff. Like, it really did, and like it kind of.
I'm with you. The beginning was was questionable. The middle was rough, but I guess the electronic score just got in the mood, because it didn't feel like the kind of shit that you kind of see in like a lesser style over substance kind of movie. Is like, I felt like they were going for a dark universe, and I guess I was just so grabbed by my attention. I knew they were heading in some kind of better direction.
Yeah, and
but no,
again,
I'm with you. That there are minor complaints. 3 minutes do go on a little too long, but yeah, before you get to the final payoff, which is worth it, is like, yeah, you got the questionable beginning. So,
right. And I feel like, again, this is all stuff that could have been tightened up. And it's all like, I'm not saying that the suspension didn't need to be there. I'm just saying they didn't need to focus on it as much. And if she's supposed to be doing a thesis, maybe she could ask more questions, you know,
Dialogue or other montage of get us an idea of the character before we see her being, you know, interrogated by Pinhead at the end.
Right. And then like also like she's doing this thing for, you know, this whatever her thesis is supposed to be. And it's going to be about flesh suspension. So obviously she's going into this area already of exploring that realm that's going to bring about the Cenobite. Sure. But like maybe in the flesh suspension when she's there, you could have had that actress show more than just a common interest in this sort of thing. Maybe she gets called out by the girl on the swing. You know, like when she's down, like, hey, I saw the way you were looking, and this is not just a normal interest for you. You know, like something to kind of move it along, because otherwise it just feels like somebody that was stupid and curious and opened the box. And that's my biggest complaint, is like, even Pinhead says it's not hands that summon us, it's desire. And so we have to believe that she had the desire to want to know more and to want to go further, you know, so we need to see that. And again, it's a short film. They don't have a lot of time to develop that kind of stuff, but they could have had something to sort of shortcut it. You know, even the guy that gives her the box, where he's like, you know, you're a voyeur for this kind of stuff anyway. All you want to do is watch. You know, you never participate. Blah blah blah. And she defends herself with a thesis, and then he
could
says
have
that's
shown her enjoying it too much or something like that. Like right. You say, gets inside her mind. But yes,
that's the only that's the only complaint that I really have, is that they took too long on some of the stuff that they were trying to do, and they didn't develop enough to make me believe that she would open the box. Like, either just have me like have her getting the box as a gift, and then like show me that she's into some darker shit and it's not just a thesis or something, or just have her with the box and she just fucking opens it and get to the part you want to get to anyway, you know.
Yeah.
The suspension just padded out the runtime to me. That's it.
Who knows, maybe they were trying to be as long as the original movie, because there are some slow moments in between the cuckolding and the terror. So who knows, maybe they've seen these all back to back nonstop, and they just figured, hey, any slow moving moments, that's just that's Hellraiser. But
yeah, that's true. That's true. And again, it's minor complaints. Everything else I really liked about it. The effects were excellent. The chains coming out, like you said, they looked good. The hook stuck in her body, I remember looking pretty excellent on that actress.
Oh yeah.
She did an okay job of pretending to be terrified and screaming for help and stuff like that. The Pinhead dubs, while they were very obvious needle drops of Pinhead, still kind of made me giggle, where I'm like, hee hee, way to find a way around it and get dialogue that works for you.
Yeah, it's like if someone did a Star Wars fan film, and they just had someone in a Vader costume and they're using just dialogue from the movies. It's like, yeah, it's that kind of deal. But it was kind of well mixed, because like the other ones, you know, they didn't have any kind of real resource, so the sound was always rough on them. This one, like you say, you're like, yeah, I know what movie that's from, but at the same time, yeah, well, save yourself the time and hassle. You just had to worry about putting someone in makeup. And I used to even recall that you could even get a I think you can still even get a giant expensive pinhead type costume from certain sites. It really is a simple, just put a bunch of Q-tips on your head and, you know, plaster it all together.
Well, you have to have some kind of a support to actually get them to stick up. So you actually need something like glued to your head, like a grid with little things.
Yeah, it's like the way they skin.
Yeah, the way that they actually do it is they, in most of the effects artists, when they're doing it, they used to actually glue the Q-tips where they cut them off. Yeah, that's like the first and second one or whatever. But then they came up with the like these little thread pieces that get glued to the head in the like at that's, every cross section, and then yeah. They just thread like actual like not nails but like more solid looking and like cast to look like nails instead of being Q-tips. They started doing that later on as well. And if you're gonna do it yourself, don't use actual fucking nails. Don't cut off actual nails. Use the Q-tips. Cut down the yes. Q-tips to look like nails and spray paint them silver.
Oh god, yeah. But who knows? It's their funeral if they want to go there.
At least cut the points off the nails first. That might help, but still, Jesus Christ.
That would be your next PsyOps News Edition. Man who thinks he's Pinhead puts nails in head.
Yeah, don't do that. Whoever you are out there listening to my voice, if you're thinking about it, don't do that.
News. Don't freak us out and ruin it for all the other fans.
Yeah, I don't want to read about your stupidity. Don't do it.
Well, I think we have just about complimented and critiqued as many of these as we need to.
While sideloading in reviews of the later films of Hellraiser at the same time.
Right. Kind of like how people are now doing with the new Star Wars sequel trilogy and the new Halloween Kills, just saying, hey, it's a homage film. It's a fan film made on a big budget. It's just like, it's kind of what we were getting from Judgment. Where can we find you on the interwebs? I know where I can, but I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah. Well, I interact on Facebook. I have a presence on Instagram, and I'm also on the Twitters. So on Facebook, I'm just Court PsyOps. You can search me there. There's also the group Cinema PsyOps in Facebook groups. On Instagram, Cinema _ PsyOps. That's my meme repository for all the memes that I share for the people. And for Twitter, I'm at Court _ PsyOps. That's pretty much all the locations you're going to get me. If you want to go old school and just send me an email, cinemapsyopscourt@gmail.com.
And one of these days, Court is going to turn into Pinhead and put some hooks into Matt and tell him to come back on the social media.
Nah, I actually
won't
don't.
Ever happen.
No, like the only reason that I'm really on there is because someone needs to interact with the fans and then like our fellow podcasters for scheduling and stuff. Matt very much is taking a mental health break. Even we're just playing it up to be something else. Like he just he can't even right now.
And it doesn't even help that. I mean, I just love how once a week Darren or someone else will post and saying, someone just removed my post. Like, it's like, what the hell, Facebook? Oh, man. And I think I lost track of how many nicknames we've given Zuckerfuck or whatever he's called now.
So. I just call him Zuckerfucker. That's just the easiest route to go. Like if you get banned for no real reason or something that's like 8 or 9 years old and they just didn't remove it and give you like the grace period of, well, we let it go this long, you know, and they still ban you for it. That's being Zucker fucked when that happens. So you got fucked by the Zucker fucker. That's how I phrase it.
Oh, totally. Great having you on here, man.
Oh, yeah, I really appreciate it. This was actually kind of fun. It was outside of my wheelhouse of comfort. I don't really like critiquing fan films because I always want to give them more of a break. And I'd rather have a personal one-on-one conversation with constructive criticism for the filmmaker if they were asking my opinion. So for everybody out there that if I reviewed your fan film on this show and you didn't like what I had to say, I apologize. I wasn't trying to be hurtful. And if you want to have a meaningful dialogue about it, you got all the ways to reach me.
I'm sure this is as meaningful as it got. They've already had to wade through endless YouTubers trolling them, saying, this sucks ass, you know.
Yeah, fuck. Stay away from the comics section and just disable comment sections.
I was really surprised how many didn't turn off comments. I know I would.
Yeah, I would have too. Totally.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, feeling down? Feeling low? Not enough podcasts about movies in your life? Why not try?
They must be destroyed on sight!
the new podcast cure-all, sure to get you right with the world and on a path to better living. We have exploitation, we have Italian horror, we have zombies, we have slashers, we have crime films, we have spaghetti westerns, we even have sci-fi and sex comedies. So take a dose of...
They must be destroyed on sight!
As needed, and let the hosts, Lee Russell, Daniel Harper, Paul Romali, and the odd guest host cure what ails you.
Warning, may cause atrophy, African consumption, black fever, bone shave, tin cough, colic, cramp colic, dropsy of the brain, elephantitis, grocer's itch, jaundice, mania, miasma, mortification, palsy, Pott's disease, rheumatism, scurvy, St. Anthony's fire, summer complaint, and worm fit in some people. Consult a physician before listening.
Did you ever see a film at such a young age it left you traumatized with cinematic wounds?
Necrophilia.
It's a dead issue, man. Don't push it. Cinema Psyops is a weekly podcast documenting an ongoing experiment on the mind of an unwilling test subject.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Oh, no one should have to watch this?
No one should have to watch this movie.
Surprisingly, it's not a topic that a lot of people really want to tackle.
I'm shocked, prudes.
I know, really.
Right?
It's the next sexual frontier that no one wants to explore.
I am, in the most sincerest defenses, disappointed in you.
It takes a powerful goddess like Connie jam her arm down the monster's throat and kill it. I'm still tripping out over that. Even as a kid, I was like, I gotta find a girl like that.
Every week, I get a new look of disappointment that I never thought I could get out of.
It's unimaginable. At 12 years old, you should not be watching this movie.
Obviously.
At 13, you should not be. 14, you shouldn't be. I'm not entirely sure even 17-year-olds should be watching this movie.
Just because you're offended by something doesn't mean that you have the right to demand that it doesn't exist.
Watching this film again, I had all of this like little nerd glee with everything that kept
little history
up.
Doll yeah, popping up
absolutely.
At you.
So I totally loved this film.
Hey, I know why you know, couldn't see that. It's because your brain's warped watching this shit at 12 years old.
Yeah, this is a rough movie. I told you ahead of time when we were getting ready to do it that it was.
How
be
did
a rough
you watch
one.
This shit at 12?
Because physical wounds heal, cinematic ones don't. Listen to Cinema Psyops.
Hey everybody, I'm Corey
and I'm Zach. And we're the hosts of Podcasting After Dark, a cast dedicated to late-night horror and sci-fi of the 80s and 90s, often found on HBO and Cinemax.
You know, the movies your parents didn't want you watching as a kid. You can find us every other week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher.
This is what you want.
This is what you get.
It's time, let's check our cue, baby. Pair it with a couple brews, baby. We love good movies. We love the bad ones too. So we watch them all and pass their lessons on to you. Oh yeah.
Bana 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 meow.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. With a one-last plot, holes are gratuitous movies. It's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy.
At EILFM.podbean.com.
Welcome to Who Was She podcast. I am your host, Tara Jabari. After a decade working in documentaries, marketing, and all things digital media, I found that podcasting is a strong medium to share stories. After years of producing for others, I decided to start my own biographical podcast. Who Was She will focus on the life of a woman throughout Baha'i history. The first season is about Lydia Zemanoff. Lydia's story explores the subjects of the power of language and faith. Her father invented the universal language Esperanto, and she came from a Jewish family and became a Baha'i. She grew up during World War I and was killed during World War II in a concentration camp, despite heroic efforts to save her life. How can one person's life intersect with so many others, connect across borders, and inspire a biography which inspired this podcast? Over the next few weeks, I will share her story with you and the lives that were most affected by her and those who affected her life as well. They include her father, Ludwig Zemanoff, her spiritual mother, American journalist Martha Root, and the Baha'i German soldier Fritz Mako, who worked for the resistance undercover while having to serve the Nazi party. I want to thank the author Wendy Heller and George Ronald Publishing for their blessing to let me use Heller's biography, Lydia, the life of Lydia Zemanoff, daughter of Esperanto, as a main and instrumental resource for this podcast. So please subscribe and learn about this amazing woman who traveled through three continents in an effort to bring unity through the power of language. You can also find more information on our Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest at Who Was She Podcast. Music was composed and performed by Sam Redd. I am your host, Tara Jabari. Join us next time as we begin our journey about Lydia Zemanoff.
Are you sick of the same old stale podcasts? Well, then join Vanessa and Darren as they dissect movies of all kinds. The two lifelong cinema lovers bring their favorites, curiosities, and first-time watches to the operating table and inject them with a healthy dose of snark. Then there's the waiting room, where they examine books and short stories. So just look for them on Apple Podcasts and where fine podcasts are available. They're part of the Legion Podcast Network. Follow them on Twitter at VD Clinic Pod. Join them on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/VD Clinic Pod. Or email them at vdclinicpod@gmail.com. They're ready to cure what ails you. And still, they just might be a little contagious.
Hi there. It's Heather from the Watching Netflix Without You podcast. Did you know that there are over 1,200 Netflix original feature films and documentaries? And that number is only growing. So I've made it my mission to watch as many as I possibly can. Then, with a delightful guest or guests, disclaimer, more often than not my brother Ryan, we spend an episode rating, reviewing, and discussing a film at length. The first half of every episode is spoiler-free for those who haven't seen it yet. And in the second half, after a very clear spoiler warning, we dive into it. And that's really about it. You can listen to Watching Netflix Without You on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more.
We now continue with our program.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jacked up.